listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We must abandon the failed policy of nation building and regime change that Hillary Clinton pushed in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria.
That was then-candidate Donald Trump addressing the Republican National Convention in 2016 as he promised an end to the U.S. policy of regime change. Over the past few weeks, some observers have wondered if Trump has decided to renege on that promise, particularly with respect to Iran. That country says the U.S. launched a massive campaign against it, sending teams to different countries around the world to disrupt its trade ties. There were reports that the administration has formed a new elite team of foreign affairs specialists led by the State Department to coordinate and promote pressure against Iran around the world. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University in International Affairs. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow on Monday.
So things are starting to heat up slowly. There's wheels in motion. There are small incremental steps being taken by the Trump administration as it gears up. You can watch the steps bit by bit for, shall we say, conflict with Iran, right? Possibly leading up to direct military confrontation. So the latest news out this week, let's discuss that quick first before we take a step back. The latest news out this week is Pompeo has announced a new team for Iran strategy, the Iran Action Group at the State Department,
right,
whose supposed goals are not regime change. They're to change the behavior of the regime, right? As if anyone believes anything they say on this.
This is the diplomatic corps having an action. That seems like a contradiction all by itself.
Yeah. All right. So at the same time, John Bolton is doing the Sunday talk show circuit, and he says the U.S. now faces an election meddling threat. Not only from Russia, of course, but also from China, North Korea, and Iran. because Iran is going to be, putting up Facebook memes too, I guess, dangerous Iranian Facebook memes, and hacking into the same election systems that it was just proved this last week that an 11-year-old girl could hack into.
Right. Okay, so, and they have 11-year-old girls in Tehran, hence Tehran's planning it, right?
I see it all laid out. I think it's pretty crystal clear, Bolton's case there. We need to take a step back, right? Even during the campaign, those of us who hoped for Trump's rhetoric about ending regime change and ending democratization and improved relations with Russia, we're at the same time aware that him and his Iran and all of his eventual appointments in the administration were pretty hawkish on Iran, right? That they were clear, and this is now coming to the fore. When Pompeo first assumed office in the Trump administration as director of the CIA, just a year ago, for those of us with longer than 15-minute memories, which excludes most of the media, the Western media that reports these things themselves, just last year, in June, Pompeo set up an Iran action group, an operations group, at the CIA, whose job was to be focused for a more robust approach to Iran. And the New York Times headline article, which you can find, is CIA names the Dark Prince to run Iran operations, signaling a tougher stance. And they're talking there about the head of this operation was Michael D'Andrea, known as the Dark Prince in the CIA, or Ayatollah Mike, who is an extremely present person responsible for thousands of drone assassinations, was deeply involved in actions that got a lot of military troops killed in Afghanistan, everyone that was talked to about his appointment asked whether D'Andrea's appointment was a sign that the CIA plans to take a more aggressive line towards Iran. Mr. Edinger, a former agency official, said, "I don't think it's the wrong read." Things like this. And specifically mentioned in the report was covert operations. The end of July, there was a report out by Reuters, reporting from the usual slew of current or former officials, anonymous current or former officials. U.S. launches campaign to erode support for Iran leaders. So the U.S., again, they mentioned Pompeo, they're more specifically. And off the records, not coming directly from Pompeo, all of these current former officials quite specifically said that the object of this campaign is to foment unrest against the Iranian government. And in case anyone had any doubts, that is what we call meddling. That's meddling on steroids. And so I have to ask, when John Bolton is talking about Iran and China and North Korea interfering in our elections, is he at this point just blaming everyone else for what the U.S. is doing to them? I mean, is that the score? So you can start to see the wheels start to click in place. Also in June, there was the annual big bash of the Mujahideen Ikalk, the MEK, the Iranian terrorist organization that up until 2012 was listed as a terrorist organization, even in the U.S. They're responsible not only for bus bombings and lots of deaths in Iran. They fought on the side of the then U.S.-backed Saddam Hussein against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war as well, getting them no amount of love by far the Iranian people. They had even killed American citizens in the early years. And the Obama administration removed the MEK from the terrorist list as they start to see the utility of this. The MEK was headquartered in Iraq when the United States invaded and occupied that country. They have since been relocated and are now being housed by the U.S. in Albania, where they are all set and gearing up and training up new recruits and in their little extremely cult-like operation that people aren't allowed to leave. And, you know, they're preparing for their use as, proxies of the U.S. and Iran. And John Bolton has spoken many times, 8 years in a row he spoke at this gathering, promising them last year that they would celebrate victory together in Tehran, meaning overthrowing the Iranian government. Well, I think he's a little behind schedule on that promise. Just in June, at the latest gathering of these, it was held in Paris. There was 33 some senior U.S. officials in attendance. Most of them, as far as we know, were paid. Certainly Giuliani was representing, you know, the Trump administration, from the outside as he does, paid well, in the tune of some, I believe it was $500,000 to attend this group. So MEK's this year's summit was attended by some 33 senior officials, including Giuliani, and a speech by Nancy Pelosi.
Uh-huh. This is a bipartisan project.
Yeah, this is Chuck Schumer has also previously spoken in support of this terrorist group, the MEK. So, I mean, that clearly indicates that, yes, the Democrats made a token voice of protest when Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, this being Obama's signature and only foreign policy legacy, but that's already essentially been forgotten, and both parties are gearing up for the coming conflict with Iran. And the opening of this operations center in the CIA, an action group in the State Department, this all indicates that the gears are slowly moving with the new sanctions, supposedly the most devastating sanctions in history that have ever been laid against any country, according to Trump. Of course, they're not just sanctioning Iran. They're also threatening to sanction European companies, Russian companies, right, Chinese companies, Turkish companies, anyone who dares continue with the UN Security Council approved Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action nuclear deal treaty that the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of. All the rest of the signatories, the EU, Russia, China, have all promised to stand by it. But with the U.S. threatening sanctions, European companies across the board, whether we're talking France's state energy company Total, or Germany's alliance, or any host of them that had been starting to invest in Iran, are all pulling out like mad.
Right. This is like a Helms-Burton-style embargo of Iran, where if you do business with Iran, you're part of the embargo.
Yes. So, and the EU has promised to defend the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and to try to defend its companies. And to do so, it's pulling out of the books a old provision dating back to the early years of the Cuban blockade that is supposed to provide some aid and assistance, some amount of some fig leaf of legal protection for European companies. But they all know, and European Union have officials have admitted to the camera that they really can't do anything to protect their companies, that it's all, they're just going through the motions. That's why all these companies are pulling out. And with them pulling out, as Iran has mentioned several times before, a big part of its reason for signing it was the removal of sanctions and the restoration of normal economic relations.
Which never happened, actually. I mean,
Never happened. But doubly so, the European Union can now obviously not fulfill, despite their declared intent to, the economic benefits and provisions of it for the Iranian government. And of course, this is all really hurting Rouhani domestically at home. That's right. I mean, he just won an election, in the last year by a wide margin.
Over again, this, really? This was his big accomplishment.
His big accomplishment, you know, restored relations, restored economic relations. Iran has suffered terribly under the sanctions because we have to remember at some point under Medvedev, Russia and China even signed up to UN sanctions against Iran in what was an obvious attempt to appease the U.S. and to get them to call off war. This is going to hurt Iran's economy. It's going to hurt Iran domestically, it's going to hurt Rouhani personally. And of course, the most likely result of this is that it will politically strengthen the hardliners, who had always said that Rouhani was naive to believe that any type of deal could be struck with the U.S. To begin with, and they've been proven right.
Right, yeah. I mean, people are actually now musing, including, I think, the Foreign Minister Zarif yesterday, musing that, maybe it was a mistake to go ahead with that. You know, you mentioned Total, the French oil company. They have pulled out. And
yes.
And this is, you know, one of the reactions to that Zarif was expressing, that, well, you know, because Iran made the pledge, they, you know, made a big show of destroying and shipping out all these different things for enriching uranium and, you know, changing production schedules, which even if they decided to change their mind, you know, these things happen in aggregation along a production process, and so they pushed it out for a couple of years. And they never got full relief from the sanctions. They got a couple of checks. They had some companies come back in and start doing business. But, you know, there was never a normal relation with the West. And there was the burden of having to help defend Syria from the United States, by the way, that went on during the... There was always a flashpoint ready for war in the immediate background while this was going on.
So this is all gearing up, you know, the economic... the political, the establishment of CIA and State Department action groups, it's all slowly closing the vise around Iran. And the EU obviously is not completely on board. If this had been Obama or Hillary Clinton, I have no doubt that they would be, but they are not because it is Trump. I expect that the UK will eventually come around and join any type of kinetic operations that are actually launched against Iran. But the Trump administration doesn't like Europe, doesn't believe he needs Europe for this. And he certainly does have the full support of both Israel and Saudi Arabia. And they will be funding a large part of this operation, I have no doubt, The MEK has acquired suspiciously large pockets with which to pay all of these U.S. officials to appear and speak at its little terrorist cult rallies, and to gear up and enlist new recruits and so far. And it's pretty obvious that it is the Saudis behind the deep pockets of the MEK.
Let me ask you a couple of questions on this. First, you know, Trump, of course, when he ran, promised to undo the deal, quote unquote, and you know, even for me, that might signal one, you know, some bad stuff, but in and of itself, I wasn't so concerned about that, because if it opened the space for a new agreement, that was good, because the agreement was lousy for Iran. In other words, it wasn't being implemented, and so you know, the get back for them was supposed to be normalized relations, and they weren't getting them. So if the situation changed, maybe it would lead to that. That was my thinking. But the other promise that he made, as he was specific to the Middle East and to that, you know, to that part of the world generally, no more regime change and nation building. And this seems to fly, at least the implied threat coming from Washington now implies a complete negation of that campaign promise. And then the last thing goes to this point. As the U.S. has been slowly in the long game isolating itself by sanctioning this country and that country and that country until finally they're going to end up in a room by themselves, China is in a unique position of being able to break this blockade, because the U.S. cannot isolate China without starving, in essence, because we buy most of this that we use from China. Do you think they're going to play a role in trying to moderate the approach towards Iran?
Well, I think they're just going to stand straight in the face of it. I certainly don't expect China or Russia or even possibly Turkey to, you know, follow U.S. Demands to stop business with Iran. China gets a significant portion of its energy mixture from Iran. They're very important, and you know, you can't mess with China's energy supply. China's certainly not going to have any of that. So that will continue. Turkey has also announced whether they could stick by their guns is another matter. You know, they're coming under U.S. sanctions and tariffs now. You know, on that as well as other, you know, unrelated matters. But Turkey has announced that they will continue to purchase energy from Iran. And Russia is, you know, they regard Iran as a strategic ally, partner, you know, in multiple spheres. Economics is just one of those. They continue to do for nuclear cooperation with Iran. Remember, Russia has constructed Bushehr, Iran's you know, civilian nuclear power plant for energy, which they are you know, have every right, legal right to do as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and provisions within the JCPOA. And Russia is continuing to develop, may start laying the ground for another nuclear plant in Iran as well. And Russian energy companies are getting on the ground in Iran, particularly in space that has been evacuated by France's Total and others, in being the partners for, you know, rebuilding Iran's energy production and distribution infrastructure. You know, it's drills and pipelines and so on that have been, you know, neglected after, you know, more than a decade of being starved from investment capital from the outside world. So Russian and Chinese, you know, and some other companies are well positioned to do well in Iran, to grab up, you know, the areas for investment and partnerships at relatively good deals. And they're already fairly well insulated from U.S. sanctions by years of having suffered the same themselves, and China simply having its own development banks and so on. They'll still take, I think, some, you know, middleman measures of trying to skirt you know, U.S. sanctions, you know, from, you know, the commanding heights of global finance, just for their own ease's sake. But I think that Russia and China and some others are going to actually do very well by all of this. Yeah. I don't believe that the U.S. has the military potential to overthrow the Iranian government. And I really don't know what they're thinking there. They're not going to change Iran's behavior, because Iran is basically on the backstep. They're making a large noise now about winding up, Syria thing, and what both the U.S. and Israel are saying and demanding of Russia is that Russia get Iran out of Syria, which is all rather amusing, because of course this has very little to do with Russia. The matter of Iran being in Syria, that's a matter for Iran and the Syrian government,
right.
And that's their decision.
That's right.
Syrian government, no matter what the United States and Israel proclaim, has the right to ally with whoever they want.
That's
the
right.
U.S. and Israel. I mean, the U.S. constantly complains to about Eastern Europe that Russia can't stop countries from joining NATO. They can join if they want. Well, that goes two ways, and certainly the Syrian government can ally with Iran if they want, and they have every reason to, because bringing Iran, in the form of advisors and weapons and the training of the popular mobilization units, the Shia militias, that were instrumental to defeating ISIS, not only in Syria, but as the U.S. was forced to admit, in Iraq as well. None of that would have been necessary if the West, the U.S. and the EU and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar hadn't been spending 7 years in a bloody jihadi proxy war to overthrow the Syrian government. So this
right.
is just another example of backlash of really stupid U.S. policy in the region. They overthrow the Iraqi government, occupy the country,
right.
and with a democratic, at least in form, a democratic government results, with voting groups in Iraq voting along ethno-religious lines, which means a Shia majority,
right.
which means Iraq naturally gravitated closer to Iran,
right.
Changing the balance of power significantly, in the region.
That's correct.
Which is complete backlash on the U.S. for that. They somehow thought they could install Ahmed Shalabi and have a government that would be completely supplicant to the U.S. and everything. And instead, what they got is a government that has actually shown, both in Syria, and towards Iran, some degree of sovereignty, of resistance. And it has to be mentioned, Iraqi companies are suffering under the threat of U.S. sanctions against Iran as well, because a lot of Iraqi companies do business on both sides of the border. They do business with Iran, which is, they're neighbors. They sit right on each other's rather large border. So that should be a surprise to no one, not to mention, the ethno-religious agreements.
The geography plays an interesting role in the whole question of Iran being in Syria, because physically Iran can't be in Syria without access over Iraq. There's no water route that doesn't require them to cross over Israel's land or Jordan if you're going to go a long way over to the Red Sea. If you're going to use the air, unless you fly over Iraq, you've got to fly over Turkey or Saudi Arabia to get there, and Jordan. So if you don't have favorable relations with Iraq, which they now do as a consequence of the U.S. invasion, then you don't have the means to support anything in Syria.
Not only that, but the Russian operation in Syria itself, dating back to 2015, would not have been possible without air overflight of Iraq,
right.
because the Turkey shot down the Russian plane on the Syrian Syrian Turkish border, and that and the use of the straits was being heavily I want to say openly restricted, but being slowed down and harassed with every possibility that Turkey could close the Black's, you know, access to the Atlantic off from Russia through their control of the Black Sea, the Dardanelles. Russia needed, you know, they supplied everything in that air mission. They got everything on the ground by air, and they did it over Iraq. And it would essentially have been impossible for Russia to keep this operation, you know, supplied without the use of Iraqi airspace. And, you know, that must have really flown in the face of the United States.
Let me ask you one final thing. We've got about 2 minutes left. In terms of the U.S. war against Iran, the Caspian Sea, which is pretty much where Tehran sits, very close. Of course, Russia has a great deal of frontage. You've got Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Iran, and Kazakhstan. So,
Kazakhstan.
All right. So the U.S. Projecting naval power in there against Iran. How exactly does that happen unless they fly the boats in?
Wait, well, that's not going to happen because there was just a meeting of the Caspian Sea countries where they did not agree completely on who gets what as far as energy and mineral rights with and fishing rights in the Caspian. They're still at loggerheads on that. But the one thing they did agree to is completely disallowing any access to the Caspian military use by any country that is not itself a littoral state of the Caspian. And I think that specifically was done with, and they finally agreed to with, you know, the notion that the U.S. is gearing up for, you know, I don't believe they intend to put a million U.S. troops into Iran, but at the very least, air and cruise missile strikes, and supporting, minorities like the Baluchi, terrorists like the MEK, the usual type of regime change, color revolution stuff. That's the stuff we'll be looking forward that the U.S. will pull up against Iran. And they'll, of course, have the support of the not insignificant Saudi and Israeli air forces as well.
So if not regime change, they are pushing to make trouble for Iran's government.
But they certainly intend to stir up as much unrest and proxy war type of activity as they can.
Okay, thank you. Mark, pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Donald Trump has locked horns with his own intelligence and law enforcement. How damaging can the rift between the White House and the American intelligence get? Well, I ask two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Moet Larsen.
The American spy agencies are mired in a public scandalous political cycle, with the investigation of President Trump putting them in an intense spotlight. But is national fame really what an intelligence agency needs? Can the professionals at the CIA and FBI escape the polarization of politics that has hit the American public? And will their findings radically change the situation in the country?
Rolf Moet Larsen, former CIA veteran who served as Moscow section chief, among other positions, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us. Now, Rolf, the American intelligence community has been accused of being politicized many times. In the Bush years, the politicians used it to justify Iraq. Now the agencies are again embroiled in a political scandal. I know you pride yourself and your colleagues for being patriotic, non-political. But can you really be about politics in this line of work? I mean, that sounds kind of like fairy tale almost.
I think it's a standard you have to strive for. I've been a lifelong political independent for that reason that you outlined, that it's crucial for intelligence officers to be independent and objective and serve the country, not just the president and the government, but we are also all citizens.
Now, the intel bureaus are taxpayer-funded. They have no private sector competition appointments. They are made by politicians. How can all that not be politicized?
Well, actually, in the intelligence profession, all of our officers are career professionals. We spend our entire career inside the agency. In my case, I was undercover for my 23 years in CIA, living abroad for most of those years. And frankly, I really felt it was not that difficult to maintain my impartiality. And I think you have to do that, whether you're collecting information or analyzing it or disseminating it, which is the essential mission of intelligence. You have to maintain an ability to tell your policymakers the truth. In other words, speak truth to power.
So is it right for an intelligence professional to be vying for a high political office? For instance, the media in the U.S. are saying that director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, may be replacing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson soon. Is it steering too much into political territory?
There's always a healthy discussion about the idea of particularly former intelligence professionals getting involved in politics. I personally don't agree with that as a principle, for the same reason for military officers getting involved in politics. But Mike Pompeo was a representative who, and often our CIA directors are, they are political appointees. And he's in a long line of CIA directors who are political appointees. And that is the way our system operates, just like many of our ambassadors overseas are aligned politically. Always with the president. So I don't find that worrisome or disturbing. I think it's much more important that the ranks of the intelligence officers remain professionalized.
How much freedom does CIA have in its decisions? I mean, for instance, Bush administration ran torture prisons, and then Obama came in and closed them. Does the agency have the power to decide for itself whether it needs things like that and whether it's ethical to use them?
That's a great question, Sophie. I feel the intelligence community has a good set of guidelines. It starts with a given set of authorities we have. In other words, we can conduct certain activities, or we call our mission, without special authority. For example, the mission of espionage is a core intelligence mission of all intelligence services. We can do that without seeking approval. When we do something like interrogation or enhanced interrogation or have prisons, that requires actually what we call a covert action finding. That requires a finding from our Department of Justice that we can do that activity, as well as very strict legal guidelines that are laid out in writing for the agency to follow. And at the times when we run afoul of that, when we are accused of crossing the line, we're held accountable by whatever standard has been laid out by our Department of Justice and our other authorities that are above us.
Now, the involvement of government agencies in this presidential election, I mean, starting from the FBI role in the Clinton emails, now the Trump investigation, investigating both candidates, and being quite public about it, it's unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, why has the intelligence community taken on this visible and political role this time around?
I agree with you, actually. I find it very regrettable. I'm very concerned about the politicization of intelligence. I do agree it's happening to some extent. I think the FBI and the CIA are still very reliable organizations that are following their guidelines. I still have complete trust and confidence in the organizations. But you're right, the questions do arise, and it's because of the highly politicized nature of our domestic politics right now between the Republicans and the Democrats and between those who support the president and those who don't support the president. So I agree, it's a very concerning time, and I think it's going to be a time when we, in a way, redefine our limits. You know, what is the proper role of the CIA and the FBI in our domestic affairs? And we've learned in our history from the past that we should stay out of American politics.
And the House Intelligence Committee has released a Republican Nunes report, which contains allegations that FBI misled the judge in obtaining permission to spy on Trump's presidential campaign. This report has already been branded inaccurate. Is it part of the blame game, or is there some substance to this?
Personally, I think it's the blame game. That's my personal view. The Nunes paper, in my view, is a Republican version of cherry-picking the facts as they choose to present them, and now I understand there's another version circulating that's the Democratic version. I frankly find that whole process to be also not something I'm proud of as an American. I prefer to see both parties sit down and discuss these things, not in the public eye, without declassifying or releasing classified information. I think all of that is not something, as an American citizen, that I would endorse or say is a good thing.
And especially with Trump's election, things haven't been like they used to be before. Like, from what I understand about the American system, the nation's foreign policy is largely decided in the White House and the State Department. And then there's Congress and the Senate, and they're more preoccupied with internal matters. This time, Congress is so active in pushing its foreign policy vision on the president. Why?
Well, I think that's true generally, Sophie. And, of course, we also have the National Security Council. And unlike Russia and some other countries, China and others, that have a more continuity in foreign policy work and making, we don't, due largely to the political nature of our system. We run in 4 or 8 year cycles for a large part of that, which is consumed with electioneering and campaigning. I think that's a weakness of our system. I still, of course, believe in the representative government idea that we sacrifice this continuity and stability in our policymaking. But it is a vulnerability or a weakness, and you can really see it right now because largely because we are dealing with unprecedented issues that we've never had to consider. We've never had such an aggressive intelligence attack, if you will, on the American democratic institutions and our election process that we just had in the previous election. That has caused a great deal of this, soul-searching inside the U.S.
So we've come now to the issue of the Trump-Russia story. You said yourself there's no hard evidence yet of Trump's straight-on collision with Russia. So why does the public believe it to be a fact? And the media in America reports it as a fact also.
I hope the American people or the media don't believe it as a fact, Sophie. I see it as the facts are clear that for whatever reason, and I question why the Russian intelligence services attacked our system so aggressively, but I think that is a fact. I don't think that's deniable. The question then is, what did that do? And what impact did that have on the results of the election? And for what reason did Russian intelligence conduct that activity? I don't have the answers to those questions, and I won't speculate because I think that would be irresponsible. I think we have to determine what happened and then decide what happened on the basis of the evidence, and I don't think we're there yet.
But that's the thing. I don't know that anyone has presented the evidence, and then the facts have been presented to the public by intelligence agencies. American public has been misled, intentionally or not, by its intelligence community many times. Like, I'm thinking WMDs in Iraq, for instance, since the consequences of that are still felt 15 years old.
Correct. Uh-huh.
So why the wholehearted faith in what the intelligence is telling them about Russia now? Especially, well, you're saying it's a fact, but every time Russia asks to show them the facts, they are unable to provide them the proof, just like with Iraq.
I think that's a legitimate accusation, Sophie, to the extent that it puts pressure on the U.S. intelligence community to do something it's hard to do, which is to present the, if you will, the secret facts or the story. I don't even know, frankly, the secret story because I don't have a reason, a need to know that as a retired CIA officer. However, if they do present the facts, there's a risk of compromising what we call sources and our methods, which would, of course, not be good. So the question is, how much evidence should be provided to the American people? I'm personally, and I stress this is my personal view, an advocate of declassifying as much information as possible and presenting it to the American people and to present it to the Russian government. I think we really need to initiate a process that we negotiate an end to this kind of aggressive cyber hacking and interference in our one another's domestic affairs. If President Putin believes the U.S. is interfering in Russian domestic affairs or internal affairs, it's not a good approach to interfere in our affairs in order to get us to stop doing it. So I think it's in the interest of both sides to sit down and talk this over and try to avoid a repetition of what happened in 2016 in the future.
Okay, let's take a short break right now, and when we're back, we'll continue talking to CIA veteran Rolf Mowat Larsen, discussing the spy agency's position amidst today's world tension. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with CIA veteran Rolf Mowat Larsen, former top CIA official and a two-decade veteran of the agency, talking about the spy bureau's role in today's United States internal and external policy. So, Rolf, Mike Pompeo has just recently met heads of Russia's intelligence bureaus to protect the American people, as he put it. So hostile rhetoric, threat naming, sanctions inside Russia and the U.S. are still pragmatic enough to work together on some issues, right?
Well, that's right, Sophie. It's really important that professionals in the intelligence business not cease cooperation, even at the hardest times. We have a long history between the U.S. and Russia that goes back in the Soviet days of setting aside our most grievous complaints against one another to cooperate in areas like counterterrorism and sometimes on counterintelligence and other issues that impact on both on our bilateral relations. And I applaud the recent meeting of the three Russian intelligence chiefs in Washington with Director Pompeo and others. I think it's a great move to reinforce the idea that we must continue to cooperate in areas of common interest to both countries.
Now, obviously, the Congress is up in arms about the Russian-American intelligence chiefs meeting. Why would the lawmakers be against this if it does bring tangible results in the fight against terrorism?
Well, I know some people in Congress, and I interact quite a bit with Congress to, if you will, inform and advise specifically on the areas that we need to talk with one another to continue keeping our countries safe, both of our countries. It's in American interest to not see any Russians die in terrorist attack, as it is in Russian interest to prevent any terrorist attacks in the United States or elsewhere in the world. So I don't think there's any dispute on that in Congress. And I think maybe some of the posturing is, frankly, political as opposed to substantive. I haven't heard anyone say we shouldn't be talking to one another on counterterrorism issues.
Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer has demanded publicly naming everyone who had contact with the Russian intelligence delegation. I mean, what that sort of all-across-the-board disclosure be damaging for the nation?
Yes, I think it sends the wrong message. If I were to talk to Senator Schumer, I would certainly urge him not to politicize. You talked about politicizing intelligence earlier. This would be an example of it. If we don't do this cooperation between one another in areas such as exchanging information and analysis on the terrorist groups and their activity, whether it's in Syria or around the world, in the Caucasus, in the U.S., we should all be fired. So we have to have the courage to do that. It's in my experience of I was involved in the earliest, if you will, liaison work between the U.S. and Russia at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I don't recall a time when three intelligence chiefs all came together to Washington, such as just happened. And so I take it as a very positive signal of a desire to do more. And I hope both sides can find the strength to do that.
Now, is this just a chance for politicians to be loud and TV-friendly, blaming spies right and left? Because on the other hand, surely they must care about the actual issues of national security, right?
Yes, I hope so. And I have a deep respect for Senator Schumer. And I would question this based on what I've seen in the media. And I hope behind it all, it's not a seriously questioning why we would be doing this at this time. I would also add that, again, this is a somewhat unorthodox view for someone like me. I'm not a believer in applying sanctions to people that are doing their jobs. We have a long history of trying to avoid that sort of politicization of intelligence. So I think we have to find a way to de-escalate the politicization of intelligence activity. It would help, again, if both sides, particularly in this case, I would have to put more pressure on the Russian side to stop interfering in U.S. domestic affairs with intelligence activity, and that would set a better environment to de-escalate the rising tensions on a political level.
Does the fact that intelligence committees on Capitol Hill haven't been briefed about this mean that the administration has no trust in Congress?
I don't think I would go that far, Sophie. I think it reflects the very sharp political dividing lines right now in our country, and not just between the Democrats and Republicans, but between within the parties themselves. I think the Democrats are struggling to reestablish their identity, to decide what part or wing of the Democratic Party will move forward into the next election cycles. And I think the Republican Party is trying to decide how much it supports the president. Some do, some don't, as you know. I'm not betraying any secrets here. So I think there's conflict and tensions and instabilities within both parties. Again, having watched this for much of my over 60 years, I've seen other times in our country when we've seemed just as confused and dazed, and we generally emerge out of it stronger than we enter that. So I'm overall confident that we'll get out of this phase that we're in stronger than we were before we entered it.
So one terror attack has already been prevented thanks to the CIA sharing intelligence with Moscow, and Putin has personally thanked the Americans for their help in that. How does it work with the intelligence agencies? I mean, how do you cooperate on some matters when there's, you know, general mistrust and hostility? I mean, how do you know you're not being conned?
Oh, I think that's a great question, and I love the question. Yeah, well, I love the question because it gets back to the heart of what we are, what I hope we are, and what we strive to be. And even on the days we don't reach this ethics, I would call it, of intelligence, our basic motto, our basic, if you will, standard is we have a duty to warn. We have a duty to warn anybody anywhere in the world if their lives might be threatened by terrorist activity. And of course, in my time at CIA working in counterterrorism, I personally instructed my officers to analyze and then provide the Russian government with information that I believe prevented attacks on Russian citizens during my time. So I consider that one of our best days, any time we help one another prevent attacks where people might, you know, be killed, obviously. And so that's a great story, and we've done it before. This is just, fortunately on this occasion, there's a little bit of recognition that it happened, and I think that's a good thing.
So do you think the recent Pentagon military doctrine shift from the war on terror to great power rivalry with China and Russia, given higher priority now, mean that the CIA's anti-terror effort will falter?
I don't think so, Sophie, because terrorism is not going away. In fact, I'm a little worried right now because every time there's been a relative lull in activity, such as we've seen since a little bit of a reduction of conflict in Syria recently, there's been a rebound, and then the terrorists have emerged in a new form. So I'm not in any way a believer in the idea that we're past this threat of terrorism. I think at the same time, the great power rivalry doesn't necessarily imply that we're enemies again or that we're back to a Cold War. I think in a way, whether you apply this idea of rivalry to China or Russia, it's a recognition that both countries should be taken seriously and that their interests are sometimes a threat to the United States, but I would describe it more as competition than adversarial.
I heard former CIA officials lament the fact that the agency has fewer resources now than during the Cold War. But does new technology like the NSA surveillance mean that fewer people are needed at the agency anyway?
I generally am not a person that believes that intelligence resources are insufficient. I think we have plenty of resources, and we have to be smarter in how we go about things. As you indicated, Technology helps leverage. We can leverage technology to, as a for, we call a force multiplier that makes us stronger. There are other ways to do it too. I don't think numbers is often the way to attack a problem. I think we need smart people. We need people who have the authorities they need, the resources they need to do their jobs. But I don't think the numbers indicate whether we have enough coverage. In other words, I believe the U.S. intelligence community, we have 16 different intelligence entities within the what we call our intelligence community. We have plenty of capability. I think where we need to make more efforts is in how we decide what we do and then being more efficient in going about our missions.
So will the agency have less need now for gathering old-fashioned Cold War-style human intelligence? Like, I don't know, talking to someone in a bar or infiltrating a guerrilla camp. Can tools like hacking, eavesdropping on phone conversations, intercepting emails, spying with drones replace the human intelligence component?
Well, you're talking to an old school person, so I don't feel I need to reform my thinking at this point in my life. So I'd have to answer you by saying there's always room. There's been room for thousands of years for old-fashioned espionage. Spies go back to biblical times. And you know, as long as there are humans on the earth, there's a need to know what our, if you will, competitors and adversaries are thinking. And human spies will never be replaced by cyber or hacking or any other, or drones or any other technology. In fact, in the 1990s, in my view, the U.S. intelligence community became too enamored with what I call national technical means, whether that was satellites or other things, to replace human intelligence. We thought the world had changed after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it hadn't. We're still living in the same world I was born in 1954. So I believed, in answer to your question, we're always going to need understanding of adversaries and even some of our friends' plans and intentions, because by having that knowledge, we'll make better decisions.
And I also feel like more technology progresses, where typewriters and old-fashioned letters are the safest thing out there still. Well, anyways, Rolf, thank you so much
That's
for
exactly
this interview.
Right. That's exactly right.
Thank you so much for this interview, this wonderful insight. We'll wish you all the best of luck. We're talking to Rolf Mowat-Larsen, two-decade CIA veteran, former Moscow station chief, about the CIA's relationship with the Trump administration and its role in today's chaotic world. That's it for this edition of Sophie and Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.